state opens its case against Leo M. Frank. The Atlanta Journal, Monday, 28th of July, 1913, page 1, column 1. Jury completed before recess and state was ready to begin introduction of its testimony. Last man in the last panel was accepted as the 12th juror and cleared the way for the actual trial of the case. When court reconvened at 3 o'clock, Newt Lee will probably be the first witness placed on the stand. Both the state and defense seem satisfied with 12 men chosen to try important case. Proceeding during the morning. More like that of a civil than a criminal case. Courtroom crowded but not uncomfortable. Frank appears in court, showing no sign of worry. Full story of the morning session. Personnel of Frank jury, all married except one. With one exception, the jurors for the Frank trial are married men and five are fathers. Among them is one bank teller, one bookkeeper, one real estate agent, one manufacturer, one contractor, one optician, one claim agent, one mailing clerk, two salesmen, and two machinists. The following are the jurors: M. Joe Hennings, married, foreman at 271 Marietta Street, residence 161 Jones Avenue. M. S. Woodward, married and father of two children, salesman at King Hardware Company. He resides at 182 Clark Street. J. T. Osborne, married and father of several children, is foreman optician of A. K. Hawks Optical Company and resides at 46 West End Place. A. H. Hensley, married, is a traveling salesman and lives at 74 Oak Street. F. V. L. Smith, married and father of three boys, is an electrical manufacturer's agent with offices in the Empire Building and lives at 481 Cherokee Avenue. J. F. Higdon, married, is a contractor. His business office and home are at 108 Ormond Street. Dieter Townsend, married, paying teller at the Central Bank and Trust Corporation, lives at 17 East Linden Street. He is 24 years old. W. S. Metcalf, married, mailing clerk in circulation department of the Atlanta Georgian, lives at 136 Kirkwood Avenue. Fred R. Winburn, married, has one boy and two girls. He is freight conductor on the Atlanta and West Point Railroad and has been in Atlanta since 1884. His father is D. W. Winburn, superintendent of repairs of the Atlanta Public Schools. He lives at 213 Lucille Avenue, West End. A. L. Wishy, married, 45 years old, has one adopted daughter, 12 years old. For 10 years he has been with the Buckeye Cotton Oil Company and is now cashier. He lives at 31 Hood Street. Charles J. Bosshart, single, is pressman at Foote & Davies and lives at 216 Bryan Street. W. M. Jeffries, married, has no children. He is a real estate dealer and recently lived in Bolton, Georgia. The jury which will try Leo M. Frank for the murder of Mary Fagan was selected Monday morning within the surprisingly short time of 3 hours, and the actual hearing of testimony was begun Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock. The first witnesses will be introduced by the state and will testify to the discovery of Mary Fagan's body in the cellar of the National Pencil Factory and to other circumstances which go to prove that she was murdered. A large part of the afternoon will be consumed by the state in making out its case. In proving that Mary Fagan was murdered, Solicitor General Hugh Dorsey probably will introduce Newt Lee, police officers and physicians who examined the body. Indications now are that the trial will continue during this week and probably will extend into the week following. The jury was completed after 8 panels of veneermen had been exhausted, and the last juror was the last member of the 8th panel. Had he not been eligible, other panels must have been called. Throughout the selection of the jury, Leo M. Frank sat between his wife and his mother. He seemed confident and cheerful, frequently smiling. The air of the courtroom was that of a civil rather than a criminal tribunal. The entire proceeding was free from delay or debate, and the prospect was that the trial will proceed quickly. During the entire time spent in the selection of the jury, no unusual or dramatic incident occurred to interrupt the business of selecting the 12 men before whom Leo M. Frank is to be tried. The courtroom was filled almost entirely with veneermen and lawyers. Only a few spectators had been admitted to the room, and these few sat in quiet curiosity. On scarcely any question did attorneys disagree to the point of debate, and by the time of adjournment the jury was complete and ready to hear the testimony of witnesses. Both the state and defense apparently are well pleased with the jury selected, and expect a quick and satisfactory hearing. The state has summoned 26 witnesses and the defense over 100, 30 or more of whom are character witnesses. After adjournment, Frank remained for a short while in the courtroom, and a dozen or more friends came forward to shake hands with him. Standing beside him were his wife and his mother. "I am satisfied," said Mrs. Frank, "with the progress of the trial and with the selection of the jury. I have no doubt whatever about the outcome of the trial. I know that my husband is innocent and that he will be acquitted." Eats breakfast at court. About 7:30 o'clock, an hour and a half before his trial was due to begin, Leo M. Frank, the accused, was brought to the courthouse from the county jail by Sheriff C.W. Mangum and was secluded in one of the back rooms. Shortly afterward, a relative of accused appeared with his breakfast, and the prisoner ate it in the room adjoining the jury room. At 8:15 o'clock, before the doors of the courtroom were opened, some 50 people were gathered outside, waiting to gain entrance, confident of acquittal. To the relative, E.C. Essenbach, who had brought his breakfast, Frank expressed confidence that he would secure an early acquittal and be vindicated of the charge against him. After breakfasting, the prisoner spent from the jail. Emile Selig, his father-in-law, appeared and engaged in conversation with him. At 8:20 o'clock, Judge L.S. Roan, to preside over the trial, appeared in court and repaired to the office of the deputy clerk to await the hour for convening court. At 8:45 o'clock, the majority of the veneermen summoned for jury duty were in court. Many of them were actively interested in getting themselves excused for various reasons. Several of them claimed to be members of the militia. One is a member of the governor's staff. Others claim to be little better. Continued on page 4, Kermer 1. Page 4, column 1. State opens its case against Leo M. Frank. Continued from page 1. Then invalids. They prevailed upon the sheriff to state their pleas privately to Judge Roan, who sent word to them that no excuse would be heard except in open court. At that hour, some 400 people were waiting at the doors of the court. Defense ready. At 8:50 o'clock, attorney R.R. Arnold, one of the counsel for the defense, stated, "We are going to trial. We never have intended to do anything else." It was said that one witness regarded by the defense as important, a traveling salesman, had not been reached with a subpoena. Attorney Arnold stated that, so far as he knew, no demurrer to the charge would be interposed by the defense. The defense, said he, intended to take up very little time with formalities and expected to get right down to business. The defense, said he, probably will call over 100 witnesses to the stand. It was assumed that the majority of them will be character witnesses. Attorney Arnold entered the court and was followed shortly by Herbert Haas, another member of counsel for the defense. Solicitor General H. M. Dorsey, representing the state, entered court a few moments later, accompanied by his special assistant in the Frank trial, Frank A. Hooper, and followed by his office deputy, Newt Garner, bringing two suitcases filled with papers, presumably including the affidavits which the state is said to have gathered, and including particularly those referred to in the subpoena deuces tecum taken out by the defense. Promptly at 9 o'clock, Judge Roan mounted the bench. Court was called to order. Attorney L.Z. Rosser, chief counsel for the defense, entered. Deputy Sheriff Plenty Minor rapped for order. The clerk of the court began calling the roll of the veneermen. E.A. Stevens, assistant solicitor, sat at the table of the state. Veneermen's excuses. At the defense's table, in addition to the attorneys named already, were Stiles Hopkins and L.Z. Rosser, Jr. Out of the first panel of veneermen, F.W. Stone, of 82 East Linden Street, offered a doctor's certificate that he was unable physically to serve on the jury. Judge Roan called attention to the fact that it was not sworn to by the physician and excused Mr. Stone long enough to get it sworn. R.F. Shedden, Georgia manager of the Mutual Life of New York, pleaded that he is a member of the governor's military staff. The judge declined to grant the excuse. W.H. Wynn, of 196 Cleburne Avenue, was called to fill the vacancy in the panel left by Mr. Stone. The first panel was then sworn. It retired. Panel number 2 was called. The public was admitted 2 or 3 after court convened. Mrs. Frank arrives. At 9:15 o'clock, Mrs. Frank, wife of the accused, arrived at court and went directly to her husband. Their meeting in the seclusion of the back room, whence Frank had not yet been conducted, was described as affecting. From the second panel, 4 men were excused before it was organized. They were F.A. Hull, who was ill, T.J. Henderson, who is 63 years old and exempt because of age, J.A. McCurry, who recently moved from Fulton to DeKalb County, and J.E. Benerton, who stated that he is deaf. Others were assigned to their places on the panel. In the organization of the third panel, the name of Joel Hurt, Atlanta capitalist, was called. The deputies stated that Mr. Hurt is out of the city and has not been served. W.H. Abbott, deputy clerk of the Fulton courts, asked to be excused, pleading that there was no one to take charge of his work in charge of the record room. Judge Roan declined to excuse him. Mr. Abbott then pleaded a slight deafness in one ear. And I'm almost overage, he added. Almost is not far enough, the judge remarked, still refusing to excuse him. W.H. Scott, who declared that he was too ill to serve, was the only veneerman excused from the third panel. Five veneermen were excused from the fourth panel. They were George Matheson of Buckhead, on account of being assistant chief of the county police, John W. Alexander, capitalist, 439 South Prior Street, account of illness, W.M. Donahue of Buckhead, who presented a certificate to the effect that his wife is very ill and needs his presence. E.A. Massa, manufacturer, 305 East Fair Street, account of being overage, and J.H. Gilbert of South Bend, who stated that he has uremic blood poison which has affected his nerves, making it impossible for him to sit through the trial. On this panel was one Negro, Earl Davis, of Collins Street, the only Negro until then appearing in the jury room. In the fifth panel, George R. Wall, who is ill, F.M. York, whose wife is in a critical condition, and W.I. Brooks, who has moved to DeKalb County, were excused. From the sixth panel, H. Manass, of 112 Jefferson Street, who is deaf, was excused. Sitting at the table with the Solicitor General was W.J. Coleman, of 146 Lindsay Street, the stepfather of Mary Fagan, the murdered girl. Dr. Connolly, excused. From the seventh panel were excused Dr. E.L. Connolly, of 53 Ashby Street, and Reverend W.F. Burdett of the northern part of the county. Dr. Connolly stated that he is over age. How do you know? Asked Judge Rowan, smiling. Dr. Connolly replied, My mother told me so. Mr. Burdett was excused on the ground that he is a Baptist minister engaged in holding a revival. From the eighth panel were excused C.W. Johnson of 140 Gaskell, a minister, and J.M. DeFore of East Point, who pleaded illness. In the eighth panel was H.C. Ashburn, a member of the coroner's jury, who heard the original evidence in the case. He remained on the panel, but will be excused for cause. Solicitor calls case. After the eighth panel had been organized, Judge Rowan asked the solicitor formally what case he had. The solicitor called the case of the state of Georgia against Leo M. Frank. The hour was 10 o'clock. Manola McKnight, the Negro cook at the Frank home, was called among a list of witnesses. Her husband, Albert McKnight, was called too. He did not answer. The negress stated that she was compelled to make her famous affidavit against Frank and that she would deny it in court. After announcing his case of the state against Leo M. Frank, the solicitor began calling the list of the state's witnesses, 26 in number. It was expected that others were to be called later. The list included none save material witnesses, it was said. No new names appeared on it. Connolly not called. They were J.W. Coleman, stepfather of the murdered girl, Mrs. J.W. Coleman, the mother of Mary Fagan, George W. Epps, a newsboy, Police Sergeant L.S. Dobbs, City Detective L.S. Starnes, W.W. Rogers, a court bailiff, City Detective John Black, Miss Grace Hicks, J.M. Gant, Pinkerton Detective Harry Scott, City Detective B.B. Hazlitt, E.F. Holloway, M.B. Darley, William A. Giesling, Dr. Claude Smith, City Bacteriologist, Dr. J. W. Hurt, coroner's physician, Dr. H. F. Harris, president of the State Board of Health, E. L. Perry, E. S. Smith, Miss Montine Stover, Albert McKnight, colored, Manola McKnight, colored, Miss Helen Ferguson, Mrs. Arthur White, L. Stanford. Crowd gathers early for the Frank trial. This picture shows a few of the throng that gathered in front of the old City Hall at Pryor and Hunter Streets, where the Frank started Monday morning. The courtroom, which is on the first floor, has accommodations for 250 people, and during the early stages of the trial, a large portion of this will not be available for the public, as 144 witnesses have been summoned. Deputy Sheriff Plenty Minor is in charge of the courtroom. Three of the list did not answer. One was Detective Hazlitt, who was announced to appear later. Another was Albert McKnight, Negro husband of Manola McKnight, Negro sweeper, before notaries public. Mr. Arnold said that as soon as that was answered by the state, he had a statement he wished to make to the court. Attorney Frank Hooper replied to Mr. Arnold and announced that while the state did not concede it could be compelled to produce these papers, it would agree that when called for and shown to be material, the papers would be furnished by the state. Attorney Arnold asked Solicitor Dorsey to dictate to the court stenographer the state's agreement on this point. Solicitor Dorsey dictated the following. Without conceding the right of the defendant to have these affidavits and statements now in the possession of the state nevertheless agrees that whenever same are shown to be material to the defense, they will be furnished by the state. These affidavits and statements, taken stenographically, are four in number and were made May 18th, May 28th, May 24th, and May 29th. Frank in court. When the witnesses for the state and the defense all had been called, Leo M. Frank, the accused, was brought into court by Sheriff Mangum to confront them as they were sworn. He took his seat beside Attorney Rosser. He was followed into court by his wife, Mrs. Lucille Frank, and his mother from Brooklyn. Both took seats near him within the railing. C.B. Dalton was called by the state as another of its witnesses. A partial list of the witnesses called for the defense is as follows. The total list numbered over 100, including many character witnesses. Defense witnesses: F. Segedly, Annie Hickson, Mrs. Levy, Mrs. Josephine Selig, Emil Selig, H. J. Hensey, R. H. Haas, W. H. Mincy, who did not answer, J. T. Spear, E. F. Skipper, who did not answer, E. L. Centel, May Barrett, C. H. Carson, Mrs. Rebecca Carson, Harry Denham, Harry Gottheimer, Miss Corinthia Hall, Miss Hattie Hall, Mary Burke, Lemmy Quinn, Herbert J. Schiff, Ella Thomas, C. B. Gilbert, Frank Payne, Eula Flowers, Alonzo Mann, Joseph Stegar, Ike Strauss, J. C. Loeb, L. J. Cohen, Emma Bibb, Mrs. Bessie White, Joe Williams, Wade Campbell, William McKinley, J. E. Lyons, Dora Lavender, M. O. Nix, Jerome Michael, Mrs. M. G. Michael, George W. Parrott, Mrs. M. W. Meyer, Rabbi Marks, William Taylor, Mrs. Beatrice Taylor, Fred Weller, Mr. and Mrs. Charles Eisenbach, Carl Wolfsheimer, Ed Montag, J. D. Fleming, T. T. Brandt, Flossie Shields, Dora Small, Mrs. R. Freeman, Charles Leake, Mrs. Ike Strauss, Mrs. T. J. Cohen, Milton H. Cleveland, Julia Fuss, Walter Pride, J. C. Matthews, W. B. Bowen, M. W. Meyer, A. E. Meyer, A. E. Marcus and Mrs. Marcus, A. E. Haas, Ike Haas, Leonard Haas, Leopold Haas, William Montag, Ike Hirschberg, A. B. Levi, Bert Kaufman, Robert Schwab, Otto Schwab, William Rosenfield, Sidney Levi, Louis Elsis, J. C. Gershon, George Gershon, Walter Rich, B. Wildauer, Sidney Levi, Saul Samuels, Arthur Heyman, and others. Character of accused. The number of character witnesses denoted that the defense intended to put in issue the character of the accused. The fact that E. L. Centel and E. S. Skipper, who claimed at the coroner's inquest to have seen Mary Fagan on the streets during the afternoon and evening of April 26th, indicated that the defense considered an attempt to prove that Mary Fagan did leave the factory after she entered it for her paycheck. It was also significant that among the witnesses were the names of people who claimed to have been playing cards at the Selig residence on the night of April 26th, showing the defense was intending to prove the statements made by Frank at the inquest about his movements that evening. After the prisoner entered, Mr. Arnold asked the court's permission to move the defense's table closer to the witness stand. In the rearrangement, Frank sat between his mother and wife. The three of them chatted and smiled while the first jury panel was called back. The first panel was called to the box at 10:40 o'clock. Solicitor Dorsey announced the case to the panel. R.F. Shedden was excused because of his position as a member of the governor's staff. Solicitor Dorsey asked this usual formal question of the panel. Are you or your wives related by blood or marriage to the defendant, deceased, or prosecutor? Mary Fagan's stepfather, J.W. Coleman. He is among the state's witnesses at the Frank trial. As each veneerman's name was called, Solicitor Dorsey asked this series of formal questions. Have you, from having seen the crime committed or having heard any of the testimony delivered on oath, formed or expressed any opinion as to guilt or innocence of the prisoner at the bar? Have you any prejudice or bias resting on your mind, either for or against the defendant? Is your mind perfectly impartial as between the state and the accused? Are you conscientiously opposed to capital punishment? As each veneerman qualified under those questions, the solicitor would proceed with the usual legal formula, announcing competent and directing juror, look on prisoner, prisoner, look on juror. W.S. Copeland was excused for cause, being past 60 years of age. O.P. Camp was struck by the state. Camp had stated that he was conscientiously opposed to capital punishment on circumstantial evidence. A.W. Brewerton was struck for cause, being opposed to capital punishment. W.H. Wynn was struck by the state. R.G. Elliott was struck by the defense. T.C. Lauren went off for cause. First panel exhausted. L.A. Smith went off for cause. C.T. Hopkins, Jr. was struck by the state. W.F. Cates went off for cause. T.G. Young of 42 Loomis Street, foreman for the Georgia Railway and Power Company, qualified on all questions asked and was passed by the state. Reuben Arnold asked the privilege of questioning him. Mr. Arnold asked him if he was not related to the slain girl, Mary Fagan. Young answered that he had heard that his wife's stepfather was related to the Fagans, but that he himself knew nothing positive about it. Mr. Arnold then asked if the witness and his wife had not discussed the Fagan case. Mr. Dorsey interposed an objection. Before certain law books could be produced, Mr. Arnold said he would pass the question, and the defense struck Young. While Young was being examined, Newt Lee, the Negro night watchman who discovered Mary Fagan's body, entered the court in custody of a deputy sheriff and passed on to the witness room beyond. D.B. Henry, the last man in the panel, went off for cause. The panel had been exhausted without a juror being selected. In the second panel, Howard Oliver was struck by the defense. H.E. Lackey went off for cause, being opposed to capital punishment. O.L. Sperlin was struck by the defense. Four jurors selected. The first juror to be accepted was A.H. Hensley. He was accepted at 11:20. He is a traveling salesman for the Franklin Buggy Company of Barnesville, Georgia, and resides at 74 Oak Street. The next man called was accepted F.V.L. Smith, an electrical manufacturer with offices in the Empire Building. He resides at 481 Cherokee Avenue. A.J. Scheibe went off for cause, admitting prejudice. E.E. Hawkins, a Negro, was struck by the defense. L.F. Davis went off for cause, being opposed to capital punishment. David Woodward went off for cause, prejudiced. M.J. Sewell went off for cause, prejudiced. J.F. Higdon, a contractor residing at 108 Ormond Street, was the third juror accepted. The next and last veneerman in panel number 2, F.E. Winburn, residing at 213 Vidotto Way, Ansley Park, also was accepted, making juror number 4. Four more accepted. In panel number 3, four more jurors were accepted. John Witherspoon was struck by the defense. H.J. Kugler went off for cause. T.J. Hale went off for cause. J.T. Hayes was struck by the defense. A.L. Wisby, of 31 Hood Street, cashier of the Buckeye Cotton Oil Company, was accepted. E.L. Wynn went off for cause, prejudiced. W.H. Abbott, deputy clerk of the Superior Court, also said he was prejudiced and went off for that cause. K.P. Mason went off for cause. W.M. Jeffries, who resides in Collins District, a real estate man with offices in the Empire Building, was accepted. Boyd Perry went off for cause. M. Joe Hennings, a foreman at 271 Marietta Street, who resides at 161 Jones Avenue, was accepted. M. S. Woodward, a salesman for the King Hardware Company, who resides at 182 Clark Street, was accepted, exhausting the panel. Another juror was added from the fourth panel. Samuel Schoen was struck by the state. W. F. Singleton was struck by the state. Earl Davis, a Negro, was struck by the defense. C. S. Cantrell went off for cause. John W. Collier went off for cause. After W. W. Hammett, salesman for the Kingsbury Shoe Company, 34 Decatur Street, had qualified under the questions asked by the solicitor asked him if he had not expressed an opinion about the case after he was summoned or just prior to receiving his summons. Hammett replied in the negative. Mr. Dorsey asked him, "Haven't you recently expressed an opinion that Frank is innocent and Conley is guilty?" Hammett replied, "No," that he had read reports in the papers and had discussed the case, but had not expressed any positive opinion. He was struck by the state. Fight over juryman. A.F. Bellingrath, a master plumber, residing at 91 Millage Avenue, qualified and was accepted by the state, but the defense interposed. Attorney Arnold inquired if he was a brother of Henry Bellingrath, one of the men seated at the solicitor's table and aiding the solicitor in striking the jury. Mr. Bellingrath replied in the affirmative. Attorney Arnold asked if he had talked with his brother about the case after he was drawn on the jury. Mr. Bellingrath replied, very little, that Henry told him Friday or Saturday that he had been drawn on the jury. He denied having expressed a positive opinion about Frank's guilt. Attorney Arnold asked him a direct question. Haven't you formed an opinion from the newspapers, and haven't you expressed your opinion to the effect that Frank is guilty, and didn't you express such an opinion in the presence of Mr. Brent? Mr. Bellingrath said he had stated that it looked that way. Mr. Arnold insisted that Mr. Bellingrath be disqualified. Both Solicitor Dorsey and Attorney Hooper for the state read Supreme Court decisions to the effect that a juror could have expressed an opinion from rumor or newspaper reports and still be competent to serve if his opinions had not become fixed and had not been formed from hearing evidence under oath. Attorney Luther Z. Rosser arose and stated that it was a matter largely within the discretion of the judge. Mr. Dorsey demurred, saying that it was not a matter of discretion but of law. Judge Rowan ruled that Mr. Bellingrath was disqualified. D. Berger went off for cause. Ninth juror selected. J.T. Osborne, an optician with the A.W. Hawks Company, was accepted, becoming juror number 9. He lives at 45 West End Place. J.H. Jones went off for cause. H.D. Hurlburt went off for cause. S.J. McDowell struck by the defense. 10th juror selected. The 10th juror was selected from the 5th panel, on which, through some mistake, there were only 11 veneermen. Edwin F. Johnson went off for cause. W.C. Willis went off for cause. H.C. Hasty went off for cause. A.H. Cook was struck by the defense. C.H. Candler went off for cause. George R. Law was struck by the state. S.C. Owens went off for cause. J.C. Henderson went off for cause. B.M. Brown went off for cause. D. Townsend, paying teller of the Central Bank and Trust Corporation, residing at 84 Whitehall Street, was accepted as a juror. C.A. Vaughn went off for cause. None from 6th. No juror was selected from the 6th panel. Ben F. Willis was struck by the defense. C.N. Patton went off for cause. W.H. Hudson was struck by the defense. G.R. Milner was struck by the defense. John Head went off for cause. C.H. Allen went off for cause. B. N. Carroll went off for cause. Robert Schmidt went off for cause. P. F. Barber went off for cause. O. Wingate went off for cause. T. E. Winslow was struck by the state. A. W. Wofford was struck by the defense. 7th panel. No juror was selected from the 7th panel. H. H. Kelly went off for cause. M. A. Long went off for cause. C. W. Gittens was struck by the defense. H. T. Ferguson went off for cause. W. L. Merck was struck by the defense. F. E. Walker went off for cause. T. B. Sale went off for cause. W. L. Gaston went off for cause. C. L. Asbury went off for cause. J. W. Chatham went off for cause. C. W. Seagraves went off for cause. Carl Weinmeister went off for cause. Jury is completed. The jury was completed from the 8th panel, the very last man on the panel becoming juror number 12. No other panels had been organized. F. L. Miller was struck by the defense. H. L. Solomon went off for cause. W. S. Metcalf, a mailing clerk in circulation department of the Atlanta Georgian, was accepted. H. C. Ashford went off for cause, having been a member of the coroner's jury that conducted the inquest in the Fagan case. E. C. Wackendorf went off from cause. Nicholas Itner went off for cause. Bud Waits went off for cause. W. W. Sorrell was struck by the defense. Saul Benjamin went off for cause, having been a member of the grand jury that indicted Frank. C. J. Bosshart, pressman, employed by the Foote and Davies Company, living at 260 Bryan Street, was accepted. He was the last veneerman available. Had he not been accepted, it would have been necessary to organize other panels. The veneermen who had not been organized were excused from further duty with the case. The jury was completed at 1:25 o'clock. Immediately upon the completion of the jury, the 12 members of it were called and were sworn. Court then recessed at 1:30 until 3 o'clock. Escorted by deputy sheriffs, the 12 jurors, who will decide Frank's fate, went at 2 o'clock to a Prior Street restaurant. The defendant in the case, with Mrs. Frank, remained in the prisoner's room under guard of a deputy sheriff while the court was in recess. Frank and Mrs. Frank ate luncheon together in the prisoner's room. When the last juror had been selected, the defense still had 3 strikes left and the state 2. Page 4, column 6. No new testimony will be given to jury by Newt Lee. Negro night watchman says he doesn't know Conley, the sweeper. Merely will repeat story of finding body. Newt Lee's testimony to the jury, before which Leo M. Frank is to be tried, will repeat his statements to the police. He will add nothing new and will give no testimony involving Conley, the Negro sweeper. To the jury, as to the police, Newt Lee will describe merely how he found the body of the murdered child in the cellar of the pencil factory, and afterward told the police of his discovery. As he waited at the courthouse with other witnesses Monday morning, he said that Conley, the sweeper, is unknown to him, and that he has told all that he can tell. But he was more interested in his taste of liberty, his first opportunity within the last 2 months of breathing the open air, than he was in the approaching trial. While being brought from the tower to the court, he asked the privilege of stopping to look at the heavens, as he put it, and to breathe the fresh air. Page 1, column 3. Court scenes at Frank trial. How it looks inside and out. Court scenes at Frank trial. How it looks inside and out. 3 distinct crowds are there, some laughing, some whispering. Speculations on case. There were three crowds at the Frank trial Monday morning, and each had an aspect and characteristic as different as east from west. The crowd in the courtroom, the crowd around the door and in the street, and the throng of witnesses swarming through the upstairs rooms. As one approached the red brick courthouse down Hunter Street, he could see the corner near Prior black with people. A car would turn the curve, the motorman clanging his gong vigorously before the packed mass would open and let the car grind by. They were mostly men and boys. At intervals, a woman accompanied by an escort would struggle into the doorway and up the stairs. She was a witness, probably a factory girl. Clear across Prior Street, the crowd outside extended. People stood in the doorway of a drugstore, in the street, in little groups on the sidewalk. It was a silent throng on the whole, speculating in whispers as to what was happening within. Doors closed to scores. There were hardly 50 out of the hundreds without who could hope to get inside the building. Yet there were, content to wait hour after hour, satisfied that they could look at the windows of the building which held a man on trial for his life. They could see the people in the upstairs windows laughing and chatting, but beyond the guarded threshold where lawyers were fighting over jurymen, continued on page 5, Kermer 1, page 5, column 1, court scenes at Frank trial, how it looks inside and out, continued from page 1, after jurymen they could not hope to penetrate. If one made his way past the crowd around the door, he was stared at. They were wondering what connection you should hold with the case. Batter your way to the door. There is a narrow lane leading up a flight of steps to the door of the courtroom. It is bordered on both sides by men, their hands on each other's shoulders, waiting until the moment comes when the door is open to the spectator. An officer keeps that lane clear. Another officer is at the door, asking every man who enters what his business is. On the steps leading to the second floor are more people. Push through them and go upstairs. Here is the most interesting phase of the whole trial, like a picnic party. The rooms are crowded with men and girls, laughing and chatting as if they were a pleasure party. There is none of the morbid curiosity of the street crowd here. These are the witnesses, young men smoking cigarettes and lounging in and out the doors, young girls, most of them from the factory, dressed in gay colored and white dresses, firing good-natured sallies at one another. "Are you subpoenaed?" they cry. And you, isn't this a lark?" Downstairs again to the first floor. If you can get past that suspicious individual who is guarding the door, you be the envy of every man on the landing, for you have gained entrance to the coveted courtroom. How it looks inside. But is it worthwhile? There is nothing sensational about this courtroom. In front of you is the railed enclosure which holds the judge's stand and 5 tables and a score of chairs. Here are the lawyers. That man in the blue suit is Hugh M. Dorsey, the state's attorney. Next him is Frank A. Hooper. Hardly 2 arms' lengths away is Luther Z. Rosser. Reuben R. Arnold is sitting beside him. He, together with other lawyers conversing earnestly at the same table, are wearing linen suits. Judge Rowan presides over all. He has on black-rimmed spectacles, over which every juryman is met by a piercing gaze. At other tables sit reporters. They write furiously. One man has a pile of copy paper in front of him as high as a mountain. "Surely that will last him till next Christmas," you think to yourself. You look around. To the right and behind you are the jurymen. There are all sorts of conditions of men here of a surety. There are bald-headed men, red-headed men, black-headed men, men with glasses, and men with specs, ranging with every age from 25 to 50 and beyond. What is there, you ask yourself, that makes these men all alike? It is a curious sort of expectancy on the face of each one of them. Will he be one of the 12 good men and true to decide the fate of Leo Frank? Eager and restless. Some of them want to be chosen, are crazed with a morbid curiosity to see the proceedings at that trial. They are the ones who will be ruled out at the first panel. Others are impatient. Theirs is no interest in a murder case. They have business to attend to, a wife and children to care for. The courtroom is not uncomfortable. It is cool and rather pleasant on the whole. Dim globes of electricity hang from the ceiling, giving a sort of soft light. There is a humming noise overall. Those are the ozonators, the machines which are supposed to purify the air with fresh oxygen. Canned fresh air, you call it. Look to your right. There is an open doorway. To the left of it is another door. It leads to a room, they tell you, where there paces back and forth the man for whom is set all this preparation and excitement. The whispering crowd in the street, the excited witnesses upstairs, the harassed officers keeping the crowd back, the eager jurymen, the ozonator, the electric lights and the copy paper all there because a man is to be tried for the murder, nearly 3 months ago, of a little factory girl. Page 5, column 2. His trial underway. Leo M. Frank, Mrs. Leo Frank and her mother, cheer prisoner at courthouse, accused neither careworn nor haggard, his eyes meet those of crowd without faltering. There was one question on the face of every member of the big crowd in and around the courthouse Monday morning. To those standing without in the street, to those crowding the corridors and hallways, to witnesses flowing through the rooms on the second floor, to the packed courtroom, the query was, where is the prisoner? The man to whom the trial meant more than it meant to any other human being had been brought to the courthouse early in the morning. He was in a bare-walled little room a few feet from the doorway leading to the court. With him sat two deputy sheriffs, his father-in-law, Emil Selig, and a friend. From time to time during the morning, the curious slipped to the door and gazed in at the accused. They saw a little man whose dark eyes gazed at them unwinking through big glasses. He was pale, but neither careworn nor haggard. He wore a light gray suit striped with darker gray, black shoes, and a black and white four-in-hand tie. Hardly once during the morning did Frank sit down. He held in his hand a daily paper and strolled aimlessly around the room, flicking with it at the table and the chairs. Shortly after 9 o'clock, there was a stir in the courtroom. Guided by a deputy sheriff, two women pushed past the staring jurymen and vanished in the direction of Frank's room. They were Mrs. Frank and her mother, Mrs. Selig. The wife of the accused man wore a black suit, a black hat, and a heavy veil. Mrs. Selig was dressed entirely in white and carried a white parasol. She was not veiled. The little man in the gray suit looked up eagerly as the two women entered the room. His lips were parted in a half smile. His arms were raised toward the door. The woman in black and the man in the gray suit were in each other's arms. She spoke once as she kissed his wan cheeks and fondled the black hair. "My lad, my lad." Mrs. Selig kissed Frank on both cheeks, grasped him by the arms, and held him off to gaze in almost a proud manner at her son-in-law. Then Frank and the women gathered in a little group near the big table. All were standing. They spoke in whispers. Every now and then, one of them would pat the other on the shoulder. Frank was smiling slightly, and his wife seemed to be unable to keep her hands from touching him. She would straighten the black and white tie, stroke his coat collar, never taking her eyes from his face. Mrs. Selig took a seat over near the wall and fixed her eyes on the couple standing near the table. She was smiling too, a wistful, almost pleading smile. At intervals, she would get up and approach them. Once she took Frank by the chin and shook it gently as if to tell him that he could not lose. He laughed as she did it. Page 5, column 2. Former suspect will be happy. No matter how Frank case ends, J.M. Gant is to be married Sunday, provided trial is over. He has planned to elope, but now he'll have sure enough wedding. There is one man connected with the case of Mary Fagan to whom the conclusion of the trial will bring a great happiness. He is J.M. Gant, at one time a suspect, and now a witness. The day that brings the end of the trial will bring to him a wife. Monday morning, he sat on the steps leading to the second floor of the courthouse, chewing on the end of a dead cigar, and he told how Miss Annie Chambers, to whom he was to have been married many weeks ago, has promised to wed him next Sunday, provided the Frank trial is over. "We were going to elope just before this thing happened," said Gant, "but guess now we'll have a regular formal wedding. It'll come off next Sunday if we can make it then. If not, why, later. I was trying to get to Marietta, where we'll live, the day I was arrested. God helping me, I'll get there this time, and Annie will be with me." Page 5, column 5. One of the state's witnesses, Montine Stover. She will testify that Frank's office was empty when she visited the factory on the day of the crime, about 12:10 o'clock. Page 5, column 5. Woman charges. Police forced her to make false statement. Negro cook in the Selig Frank home repudiates affidavit she swore to against Frank. Will refuse to swear to the paper. She says Manola McKnight, the Negro cook, who signed an affidavit which is to be used by the prosecution against Leo M. Frank, said Monday morning that the police, by 3 hours sweating, forced her to sign this affidavit, and that when she is called as a witness that she will refuse to testify to the statement set forth in it. The substance of the affidavit was that, on the morning following the murder of Mary Fagan, Mrs. Frank came downstairs at the home of her parents, Mr. and Mrs. Emil Selig, with whom she and Frank made their home, and said that Frank had asked for a pistol with which to kill himself. At the time, the Negro cook signed this written statement of what is said in the affidavit to have happened at the Selig residence on the day following the murder. She was confined at police station. She declares now that the signing of the affidavit followed hours of sweating by the police, and that at the time she actually signed the paper, she was not aware of what she was doing. When the names of witnesses were called Monday, it was found that her husband, Albert McKnight, who had been summoned by the prosecution, was missing. Through statements which he made, the police came to cross-examine his wife, and he was summoned as a witness to testify to what she is said to have told him. When Solicitor General Dorsey found that the Negro McKnight was not among the witnesses, he questioned Manola McKnight, the Negro's wife. She said that her husband left home that morning as usual to go to work. "Do you think he has left town?" the solicitor asked her. "No," she said. Immediately afterward, court officers were sent to arrest the missing witness.